أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين. ولعن الله الدائم على أعدائهم أجمعين من ليلتنا هذه إلى قيام يوم الدين. Respected elders and brothers and sisters in Islam and Iman, we've gathered here for a majlis to commemorate the martyrdom of our Imam Sayyid al-Shuhada and the noble companions of Karbala. And as we sit here in this majlis, it's good for us to remind ourselves that the majlis is an incredible opportunity for us to be reminded about the purpose of our existence and of the responsibilities we're supposed to perform in order to fulfill that purpose, and an opportunity for us to learn and to gain from the spiritual connection that we are strengthening with Imam Hussein alayhi salam. There's a story that sometimes is told by the scholars to illustrate the importance of taking advantage of this opportunity to transform with the help of Imam Hussein. Once there was a beggar who was so hungry, he was crying because out of hunger, and he was asking for somebody to give him some food. There was another man who happened to have just bought some bread from the bakery, and he walks by, and he sees this man who's crying, so he goes to him, he says that, "Why is it that you're crying?" He says that, "I'm poor. I don't have enough money to buy any food. I'm so hungry that I'm crying." So the man with the bread tells him, "That indeed is a sad story. I'm going to sit right here with you and I'm going to cry with you." So he sits down next to him and he starts crying. A third man comes along and he sees the two of them crying. He says that, "What's going on here?" The first man complains about his hunger. The second one says that, "I wanted to join him and empathize with him." So he looks at his bread, he says that, "Well, if you want to help him, why don't you give him some of your bread?" He says that, "I can give him as many tears as I want, but when it comes to the bread, I can't give any of that." And with that, he got up and he left him. Sometimes we find that it's easy maybe to, once a year, participate in such gatherings, give our little sort of sacrifice, but then we don't really want to, or we're not looking for that opportunity to change. But we really do have to. It's something which is an incredible opportunity. There was a Persian poet who once had a line of poetry that he composed. He says that if Abu Turab, it's a famous line of poetry, if Abu Turab were to glance upon somebody, what would happen? You know, he just had this thing in his mind that if Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam were to give his special attention to somebody, what sort of transformation could occur? And he couldn't think about, you know, what would be the conclusion of that, because it was something that was so great for him. And he went to sleep at night and he was inspired with this line of poetry from the Imam himself. He says that if Abu Turab were to glance at somebody, then that one speck of dust could rise and do the work of the sun. Because, you know, when you have a speck of dust that you can see because of the sun ray, you look at it, it's so insignificant compared to the sun that's illuminating it. But imagine if somebody could be elevated and vaulted towards the sun. That's what can happen when we connect to the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. On those lines, one of the responsibilities that we need to take seriously is our social responsibilities and political responsibilities. Inshallah, tonight after the program, we will be heading towards the Bahraini embassy to conduct a majlis there as a means of solidarity with our brother who has been for many weeks now protesting the conditions and the injustice. We might think that, well, what does it matter if I'm there or not? What can a few gathering of a few do against a whole reign of injustice? But we shouldn't think insignificant of the act that is done for the sake of Allah with the help of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Sometimes the thorn in the side can be the downfall of that monster that can't bear it. And so we hope, inshallah, that by performing this, by participating in this lawful gathering of a majlis outside, that inshallah will be a source of pleasure to Allah Ta'ala and a source of, inshallah, change. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. The topic that we have been discussing is looking at the idol of the self and seeing how we can break it down. And one of the areas where this idol really wants to take importance is when it comes to the concept of freedom. Everyone likes the idea of being a free person. It's something that's inherent to us, and we're ingrained with this desire to be free, to be able to make our own choices. I don't know if you've spent time watching how children develop. When they're babies, they do what you want. They're sort of incapable of kind of responding too much. But as soon as they get to that point where they can start consciously taking part in activities, they want to do things themselves. They want to choose the clothes that they wear. They want to be the ones who make the decisions. If you, let's say, do something for them, they want to go and do it again because they want to be the ones who did it. If you ever go in an elevator with a child until they get to a certain age, you know how it is that they are the ones who want to press that button. It has a lot of value for them to be the ones who made that choice and the ones who actually do something. And freedom is something that is talked about a lot in the society that we're in. And if you ask yourselves this question that freedom in Western society, what kind of freedom is it? What are we getting free from? Is it a freedom from any type of restrictions? Is it a freedom from any type of predetermination? Is it a freedom from any type of God, any type of religion? The type of freedom that the Western society talks about is a type where you want to basically be the one who can do anything that you want. You have the choice. There is no restrictions. There's no barriers. Everything is broken down. You can even choose the gender that you want to be. You can choose whatever you want to do. As long as it doesn't harm anybody in the public sphere, in your private life especially, you can do whatever you want. And that's the type of freedom that's talked about. But the incident of Karbala, we see several instances that remind us that Islam has a different definition of freedom. It recognizes freedom, and freedom is something which is important, but the type of freedom that's talked about in Islam is something which is different. If you look at the story of Al-Hur, Al-Hur was named Al-Hur by his mother, and Al-Hur means the one who is a free person. When Al-Hur was martyred on the day of Ashura, his body was brought to, according to some of the reports, his body was brought to Sayyid al-Shuhada. And when the Imam sees him, he goes down to the body and he passes his blessed hand over his face. And he makes a comment. He says that, "Anta al-hurru kama sammatka أمك. أنت الحر في الدنيا وأنت الحر في الآخرة. O حر, indeed you are the one who is truly free the way your mother named you. You are free in this world and free in the آخرة. But have you ever thought that why is حر being referred to as free? He's left this world. He's lying martyred on the ground. He's been separated from all the pleasure of this world, from his family, from his wealth, from his property. He's gone. So what kind of freedom is the Imam alayhi salam referring to here? And it should be the case that if we think about that, we start to realize that freedom in Islam is something which is different. And when we talk about that freedom that our soul desires, we have to see what kind of freedom is the right type of freedom. Now, what I'd like to do tonight, inshallah, is to look at this perspective of freedom when it comes to tarbiyah. Tarbiyah means how somebody is raised, how somebody is guided towards perfection. And what I want to eventually lead to is, how is it that we are when it comes to the means of entertainment? Yesterday I talked about entertainment and relaxation and kind of luxury and those sort of things. But tonight I want to talk about the means of entertainment and some of the other negative influences in the society. It's something which is a bit different, but I want to talk about it from this perspective, that how does it work with freedom? So I first want to talk about tarbiyah. Tarbiyah, as I said, means to guide somebody towards perfection. In Islam, the way that somebody is raised is a very interesting process. If you look at nature, you see that different animals in nature or different plants, they have a certain process that they go through. If they get the right sort of, you know, rain and sun and the right type of food and nourishment, they go through the different stages and they reach their perfection. But when it comes to the human being, it's a more complex process. The way that a human being is raised is something which is very unique, and it goes back to the nature of the human being himself. So I want to look at this a little bit philosophically. I think it's, even though it's philosophical, it's not dry and boring. It's something which is very interesting. I want to take some points from some of the very important teachings of Shaheed Baheshti regarding the development of a child. What he says is this. He says that look at a human being and ask yourself this question. What is it that distinguishes a human being from other types of creatures? We have a body which grows. Well, there's a lot of other things that have a body that grows, plants and animals. We have a body that moves. Okay, well, other things move as well. We have a body that responds to different stimuli. Well, there are other organisms and, you know, plants and animals that respond as well. So what is it that distinguishes us? Is it our speed, how fast we can go? Well, there's animals that can go faster than us. Is it our ability to be like agile and acrobatic? Well, no, there are animals that are better than that than us. Is it our ability to communicate? There are animals that can communicate with each other, like, you know, using sonar and in the depths of the water and through many ways that we can't. Is it our ability to hear and to see? No, there are animals that can hear and see much better than human beings. So what is it that distinguishes us from other creatures? So he analyzes it and he says that there's two things. Number one, it's the ability to analyze rationally and to be creative. And number two, it's the ability to choose what we want to do. These are very important points, these two things. The ability to like think and be creative and to choose what we want to do. If you look at an animal, typically what it does is what it's programmed to do. When all the birds are going to get ready to migrate from the north to the south, from the cold to the warm lands, it's not like they have an option and say that, okay, well, I have an emotional attachment to this pond that I've found here, I'm going to stay back. Or when it comes time for a certain, like the mother bird to start taking care of the eggs, it's not like she has the option to say, you know what, I'm going to check out and you know, do a part-time job and then I'll go back to like my eggs. It doesn't work that way, right? When the penguins have this complicated scheme of like, you know, the father and the mother and how they sort of transfer the eggs and work together. That's what they do, right? Because that's what they're programmed to do. But a human being has this incredible ability to be able to choose for himself or herself what exactly they want to do. And this is something which is intentional. God created us this way. On one hand, he gave us incredible abilities to determine things and to be able to analyze things and to come to certain understandings. He gave us this ability to like think and process and, you know, put certain logical premises together in order to derive conclusions. He gave us the ability to learn from others. He even gave us a lot of guidance in the form of prophets and books and imams after them and ulama. But he did not force us to go in a certain direction. He left it up to us to decide what we wanted to do. And that's something which is programmed into the system. God wanted it that way. What's the proof of that? When we go to the Quran, Allah Ta'ala tells us in Surah Al-Insan, verse number 3, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم, إِنَّا هَدَيْنَاهُ السَّبِيلَ إِمَّا شَاكِرًا وَإِمَّا كَفُورًا. We have guided him to the path, but it's up to him, meaning the human being, whether the human being wants to be thankful on a practical level or they want to be ungrateful. Whether they want to make this realization of like, what am I? And how have I been created? And what has he done for me? Or they want to ignore that and they don't want to practically act upon it. It's up to them. Allah says in the Quran, if we wanted to, we could have guided all of them. The people who are denying openly God, Allah says that if I want, I could have forced them to believe in a certain way. But that's not the way that God wanted it to be. He wanted us to make that decision on our own. And so from Islamic perspective, freedom is something that we've actually been created with for an incredibly important benefit, because that's what determines the level of our humanity, how we actually use this freedom. The tests that come our way, how we respond to them. When the jinns came to Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salam, there are riwayat that say that Za'afar, the king of the jinns, or the leader of the jinns, the ones that were the Shia, he comes to Imam Hussein alayhi salam and he says that we are at your disposal. You tell us, you command us, we will destroy all of the enemy for you. And Imam Hussein alayhi salam thanks him for the offer. But he says that if you were to do that, by what means will these people be tested and tried? Very important lesson that we have for Karbala. I don't want to go into it that much, but I just want to mention here that in Karbala, we see that this whole thing was a test to see how can people use that freedom that they have to make the right choices. And then Imam Hussein Islam tells him that actually we're capable of that ourselves. You know, Imam Hussein Islam is the Imam. He could have done that himself, but that was not the means by which he was to resolve the situation. The imams were commanded to make use of the normal means to be able to deal with the situations, not to perform the miracles. Now, that was a side point, but I want to continue now on this main point, that we've been given this freedom, there's a purpose. Now, here's the question, that when it comes to being able to use that freedom and make the right choices, how should we be making those choices? What kind of environment are we supposed to make those choices in? How are we supposed to take that test? Imagine that somebody gives you an exam, and they say this is a really important exam. You've studied for it, you've been given the necessary knowledge, you've been prepared for it. And they say that, okay, you have 60 minutes, go ahead, start writing your papers. And you start doing it, and suddenly there's a lot of noise around you. There's things which are flying in front of your face. There are people who are coming and poking you. Somebody's coming trying to take away your paper. They take away your pencil. Is that fair? No. Because you're not being given a fair chance at being able to take that exam. They're preventing you from even being able to like focus and make the right choices. What's happening is that you're being distracted and you're not actually being given rights to access the freedom that is yours. And so when you actually go and take that test, the results are not going to reflect who you are. Now, when we take that to what Islam says about freedom, what Islam says is that, look, you've been created free. Now, it's important that you stay free. Don't be somebody who becomes one who cannot make those decisions in a free sort of way. Don't become somebody who is so enslaved that they can't actually be free anymore. I'll give you an example. When it comes to the gaze, the glance, an-nazar, Allah tells us in the Quran very clearly, قُلْ لِلْمُؤْمِنِينَ يَغُضُّ مِنْ أَبْصَارِهِمْ وَيَحْفَظُوا فُرُوجَهُمْ. Tell the believers, Surah Al-Mu'minun, tell the believers that they should cover their eyes and they should protect their private parts. And tell the ذَلِكَ أَزْكَى لَهُمْ, that's something which is more pure for them. And tell the believing women that they should cover their eyes. Now literally, of course, we're not meant to walk around with eye covers. What it means is that we have to control our eyes. We have to control our gaze. What is God telling us? He's telling us that don't be free with your gaze. But wait a minute. Wait a minute. Aren't we created with freedom? Aren't we created for the purpose of being able to make those choices? So why is it that God on one hand says that you've been created free, but on the other hand, he's telling us that here you're not free? If we think about it deeply, what we start to realize is that this is not actually freedom. This is actually a trick in the name of, it appears as something which is free. That, oh, you're free to make a choice of where you want to look. No, it's not freedom. Actually, it's a type of enslavement. It's like that noise that's coming and distracting you from being able to take that exam. I'll give you another example. In the books of fiqh, they talk about this idea of al-kutub al-dallah, books which are a source of misguidance. A lot of people these days, if you tell them that, hey, you know what, there's a book here, you shouldn't really be reading it. It's not okay for you just to go to the library and, you know, just walk around and pick up any books that you want. You have to make sure that it's not going to be a book that misguides you. They'd be like, what, are you talking about censorship? What, are you restricting my freedom? No, I'm going to be the one who figures out what I'm going to read. I'm going to be the one who figures out what I'm going to listen to. It's just an idea of censorship. No, that's against freedom. But the ruling Islam has for it is that it's haram for somebody to read a book of misguidance. Unless, you know, there's some special circumstance. For example, that they're reading it in order to be able to respond to it. Or there's somebody who, you know, let's say is an alim, they need to get this information to be able to understand how the enemy is thinking. We have other examples of this, right? When you have the two non-mahrams, the hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, if a man walks into a room where there is a female who's present and she's not mahram to him, and the context, of course, is where it's private, it's alone, there's nobody there, then the third person is shaitan, the third individual shaitan. Meaning what? Meaning that, okay, you should restrict your apparent freedom here. Why? Because it's not really freedom. What's happening here is you're tricking yourself. It's actually going to be a source of your not being able to make free choices. I want to quote to you a few hadith that we have. It's not just one hadith. We have a number of hadith which illustrate this concept of staying away from something, of censorship in the name of actually protecting our freedom. If you can say salawat, please. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he says, "Man taraka shahawati kana hurra." Whoever leaves aside his shahawat, his lusts, of course, which are haram, that person is free. Okay, another hadith. Kam min aqlin asirin inda hawan amirin. How many intellects and, you know, how many minds do we have, just in a loose translation, I'm being precise, how many minds do we have that are actually prisoner? What are they prisoner of? They're prisoner of the idol of self, of their nafs and their hawa, their low desires, which are ordering them what to do. Now, if you analyze that, what we understand from these is that our lower self thinks that it's freedom, but what's happening is that it's actually chaining us down. It's preventing us from being able to use our capacity to make the right choice because we can't think clearly anymore. So Islam comes and says that don't chain yourself down. Be free. Allow yourself to think freely and make those right decisions. From the time you're born until the end. This is how you are to be raised into a true believer. There's a story that's told of this one incident that took place in the life of Alexander the Great. You know, he was a great king, had a lot of, you know, pomp and fare about him. He was used to people kind of subservient to him. So one day he's parading, you know, down the street and everyone stands up for him and shows him respect. But there's one person who is known as like a wise man who refuses to stand up when he comes. Alexander the Great, when he sees him, he gets upset. He says that, why are you not standing for me? Right? I'm the king, you're my subject, you should be standing for me. So the wise man looks at him and he says that, why should I be standing for somebody who is the slave of my slave? He says, what? I'm the master, I'm the king, you're the slave of my slave? He says, yeah. He says that you are the slave of your ghadab and your shahwa. Whenever, meaning your force of anger and your force of lust. Whenever you get angry, you can't control yourself. Whenever you lust after something, you have to go for it. So you're the one who's actually a slave, and I have, you know, worked on myself. I've been able to control these things. I'm able to make judgments without being clouded and affected by having this negative chain down to these lower desires. So you are actually the slave of my slave. Now, if we take this to Western society, brothers and sisters, what's happened and what's happening? It's very serious. In the name of liberalism, in the name of freeing society from any type of shackles and chains, the reality is that what's happening is that society is getting more and more chained down. All sorts of things that before were taboo, now they're coming to the forefront. And we see that every few years, it's one thing after another thing. If you think that this is something which is just a natural evolution of humanity as it goes towards perfection, you need to think deeper and read and study and realize that this is a programmed social, it's a social program. It's been programmed. It's something which has been planned many decades prior to now. And through a complex means of using media, using Hollywood, various political figures, what they're doing is they're trying to break down all sorts of barriers and restrictions in the name of freedom. But the reality is what's happening is that people are actually being chained down as a result. They're becoming more and more imprisoned with their low desires and more easy to exploit. So let's take this now to our responsibility when it comes to ourselves and when it comes to our children. You know, sometimes people might sort of tune out when we talk about children because maybe they're not parents yet. Or they were parents and now their children have been, you know, it's kind of past that age where they can really influence them. Brothers and sisters, my experience, you know, in working for the last number of years with children and their parents is that more often than not, when we're talking about tarbiyah and the Islamic process of raising somebody towards perfection, and my apology, I don't mean to like insult anyone. More often than not, though, the reality is that it's the parents who need more tarbiyah than the children. And if the parents were to have a focus on tarbiyah for themselves, then they would see incredible results with their children. I also want to mention something else here that for those of you who aren't even married yet and you're present, don't think that this is some discussion which is sort of, you know, far-fetched and remote to you. The ability to know how to be a process, part of the process of raising somebody to be a servant of God is incredible. It's something which is the best gift that you can be given because it's the best gift that you can give somebody. And if somebody wants to truly be a good parent in the future, they have to start even before they get married because the choices that you make of, like, for example, who you're going to marry, these things are part, essential part of how you're going to eventually be able to raise your children. This is the question, brothers and sisters, that when it comes to raising our children, what approach should we take when it comes to freedom? Is it the case that in this society where basically anything goes and everything you have access to, should we be thinking that our children should be raised in a way where we're going to put them right in the midst of it? We're going to give them access to everything. Why? In the name of freedom. Because it's a free society. Freedom is good. It's a free society. I'm going to give my children access to everything because somehow they're going to, you know, just be good. Right? They're going to be able to survive all that and it's going to be great. Everything's going to be fine and they'll be good mu'minin and I've done my duty. That's one approach, but according to what we just discussed, what we're doing is we're actually not allowing our children with that type of approach to make those decisions that they need to make on their own in order to become a true human being. So this is something which is very wrong. On the other hand, there's an approach which says that, oh my God, we're living in a society where, you know, there's all this sort of, you know, freedom and, you know, there's all this corruption, facade. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to be the type of parent who doesn't let my child make any decision on their own. I'm going to tell them exactly what to do. They're going to be under my nose at all moments of the day. I'm going to be the dictator. They have to listen to me or else I'm going to show them the stick. And that's going to be the source of their salvation. Well, that doesn't work either. Right? We have many examples of parents who have tried that. Right? It also goes directly against the teachings of Islam, which says that freedom is a value, especially in the first 7 years. Children should be given that freedom. We shouldn't be barking orders at them. Of course, there are times when we need to give them guidance indirectly if possible. Sometimes we need to give them direct guidance. I don't want to go into the details, but it's essentially important to give them that freedom, especially when they're younger. So what is the right approach, brothers and sisters? When we go to the teachings of Islam, our understanding of it is the right approach is, as parents, as people who are involved with raising the next generation, and for ourselves as well, the approach we need to take is that on one hand, appreciate the fact that we've been created as people who make our own choices. But on the other hand, remove those distractions which will prevent us from making the right choices. Now, practically speaking, what does that actually mean? I want to give two examples tonight, inshallah. One of them has to do with devices. It is not uncommon these days for people at a very young age to have their own device. They have their own phones, they have their own iPads or tablets, whatever it is. And in my observations, many parents don't even consider the alternative, which is to say that I'm not going to give my child their own device. And I wonder why. Because in my experience of, you know, working with children, seeing them day in, day out, many years, one of the main factors of a child losing the way, of them not being able to make the right decisions, even though they have parents who are say their prayers, who have gone to Hajj, they go for ziyarah, they go to majalis, everything like that, but they still can't make the right decision. One of the main factors of misguidance has been the devices themselves. I want to just give you an idea of what sort of things our children are facing through these devices. Sometimes, you know, my experience has been is that many times people just don't realize, they don't get it. And there's a reason why, because as a parent, you know, parents are typically pretty busy people. It's not easy being a parent. It's one of the most difficult things, actually. To be a good parent is even more difficult. It takes a huge time commitment. It takes a lot of money as well, too. And, you know, these days we're busy, right? We're busy. We have our own stuff to do. We want to do our own, you know, we got to check in on our own Facebook. We got to, like, you know, do our things, right? So it's a lot easier to have somebody else take care of our kids. And, you know, we don't live with extended family anymore. We don't have our cousins down the street, right? So what do? We say that, my solution for raising my kids is that when I get home, I'm going to give them the device. And they're not going to bother me. I can do my cooking. I can, like, do my cleaning. I can check my email. I can read my WhatsApp message. It's awesome, right? Every day. And that's the way I'm going to raise my kid is with this. So it's a very convenient alternative babysitting solution. But brothers and sisters, I feel that it's my duty to just share some of the observations that I have about what sort of things are being given to our children in these devices. I want to give you some examples. Inshallah, if you can say salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. The first thing I want to talk about is video games. There is a video game, just as an example, that pretty much all boys have played. You know, in my experience in talking to them, if you really ask them, say, okay, like, well, have you played this one? They're like, yeah. Okay. Now, this is a game which typically is supposed to be restricted for, like, let's say 18 and above, but the reality is that most boys play. In the game, there is a scene where you have to torture somebody, okay? Like, you have to actually go and you have to torch them. You have to waterboard them. You have to, like, I don't know, take a hammer and, you know, hit them hard in places where it hurts. And if you don't actually do it, then you're not going to be able to go on to the next part. In that game, you go and you drive a car and you run over grandmothers on the street. In that game, you go through a certain place and you take drugs. Okay, in that game, you go to certain areas which would be considered as very, very indecent and inappropriate. And these are things which, you know, are sort of normal. It's very common, very popular. There's another game where they reward you depending on how well you're killing other people. If you have a killing streak, then as you go along, they give you like more and more medals. For example, there's one which says that, okay, you get a medal for like being you're bloodthirsty. Or you get another one where you're ruthless, or another one where you're brutal, right? They actually award you for having these type of qualities. There's another game which is called Roblox, okay? It's supposed to be one of the most harmless games that's very safe for children. Why? Because they say that they block out any type of profanity. What my experience has been is that children are very capable of getting around any type of filters. Okay, so they look for certain words, so they spell it a different way and they can say the same thing. And you find that, you know, parents, mu'mineen, are saying that, okay, this game is safe because it's meant for children. And the reality is that the game is being used for all types of facade. For example, in that game, one of the most popular modules is where you have children go into a high school and they act like they're in high school. And you know what type of stuff they do in, I don't know if you call it secondary school or high school here in London, but you know what type of stuff they do at that age, right? So your kids acting those things out, having the same type of conversations, the same type of role play that takes place there. When we look at these type of games and so many other games, right, you see that there are fundamental observations that we have to make, okay? And unless we think about it and analyze it, sometimes we don't realize these things. Number one is that these type of video games are extremely demanding of the person who plays them. How so? Okay, when you go to just watch a child who's in a video game, right? Try to walk by them. Try to like sort of talk to them. Right? They have their headset on. They're like deeply engrossed in it. You find that they're completely gone. They're in a different world. Why? Because the video game demands everything from them. You have to give me your eyes. You have to give me your ears. You have to give me all your abilities, your mind, everything, it's mine. So I am basically taking you as a prisoner. Number two is the type of culture and worldview that these games promote. You know, if you just go and study, like, what type of dress do the people have? Right? What type of values do they promote? Usually in the games, you find that it's a lot about, you know, who can be the one who's at the top. And if you mess up, then you get roasted by the other people, right? There's a scoreboard that keeps track of who's at the top. And it's a lot about like, okay, well, who's there? Who's going to be up? You know, it's a lot about other people determining my status for me. If you go to these games, you find that they promote a lot of laziness. Inevitably, children who get hooked on video games, they start suffering academically. And they start suffering spiritually as well. Because that becomes the purpose for which they exist. It's something which consumes them. It takes them over. They promote gambling. And some of the maraja actually have forbidden said it's haram to even, you know, have accounts on video games and to top them up because of this aspect of it. And they're extremely addictive as well. Brothers and sisters, if you knew that there was a drug that has been designed by hundreds of neuroscientists who are capable of understanding the brain and exactly what makes somebody addicted on it, and it's that drug is geared towards your children, and you know that every year they upgrade the abilities of this drug to be able to addict your child, and you know that the people who take this drug are in communication with other people who take the same drug. They're in touch. And they come over to your home without you even seeing them and knowing who they are, and they talk to your child. Would you ever be okay giving them that drug? So why would you be okay with them playing these type of video games and communicating with people like this online? It just doesn't make sense. But you find that mu'mineen are just, it's like they have no understanding of what, I mean, typically, I'm not saying, inshallah, everyone here is informed, but typically they don't have this sense and realization of how much danger there is in these types of things. When you go to the type of shows that come from these devices, I'll give you some examples. These are just baby examples. You know, a lot of times, like, parents think that, okay, well, you know, we know that there's like the bad stuff out there, right? And we don't engage in that, but you know, there's a lot of stuff like Disney and these type of things, which is harmless, right? Okay, Disney, right? You must have heard of Toy Story. Toy Story, there's a scene where you have Ken, the Barbie, and you have, I don't know, the Barbie, the lady, the Barbie. Barbie, I guess. Ken, the Barbie, Ken and the... So, you see, this is a thing geared for the children, right? And you find that, okay, they have a scene where Ken is there and the Barbie is there, and then it's suddenly like, you know, everything's there, right? It's love at first sight. No, just imagine that a child is being sort of fed this type of thing with all the imagery as well, too, not just the description from a mimbar in the mud, no, with all the music and this thing and the slow motion things and the body gestures. What are they learning? What are they learning about what it means to be, you know, one gender and another, and what sort of interactions ought to be having with one another? They're being taught, brothers and sisters, how to go about doing it, in what setting, how to look at the other. It's a lot going on there. You must have seen this one or heard of this movie, you know, having to do with like animals and in a zoo sort of thing, right? Where they, you know, the animals are typically clothed, but they have to go through this one place where they're unclothed. And you just go and you see this and you're like, subhanallah, how can they get away with such explicit imagery and themes in a child that's geared, in a movie that's geared toward children? On an akhlaqi level, you find consistently that in these shows and in these movies, the father figure is somebody who's extremely dumb, extremely weak. He's overridden by his children. He's overridden by his wife, right? An object of like ridicule. Consistently, you find the feminist sort of woman who's the one who is, you know, kind of like refusing any type of like acceptance of any type of like wanting to work with, let's say, within a family and play a certain role. Okay, and I don't mean here that, of course, that I'm not saying here maybe what somebody might be thinking here. I'm just saying that the type of ideology that's been promoted is one of like very, very strong, very much like I'm not going to accept any type of responsibility that somebody else is going to give me. I'm going to make my own choices. And we see that even in the type of songs. Yesterday I mentioned this. Here's the words for it. Conceal, don't feel, don't let them know. Well, now they know. Let it go, can't hold it back anymore. Let it go, turn away and slam the door. No, what is this saying? Right? What is this saying? It's saying that basically you can have any type of ideology that you want, but I'm going to make my own choices. I'm going to do my own thing. Right? And these are just some of many examples. You have shows which are the most popular that sometimes you see mu'mineen like, you know, following and they're posting and they're talking about, where they openly talk about, you know, incest, and they openly show these types of scenes. What type of corruption is taking place? When it comes to social media, yesterday I talked about how social media goes directly sometimes, again, not everything is bad, right? There's some very valid and important uses of it. Sometimes it goes against the way silt al-rahim, the idea of our family being tight and close together. There's another aspect of it which is extremely dangerous, that the aspect of it where our life becomes something where we live it to please other people. And I have to mention it to it here because it's something which is a creeping disease, which is, you know, affecting our society. People, you know, from a very young age, they begin to sort of judge their happiness based on what other people think about them. This starts at a young age when they start taking photos of themselves, they start posting them, and it becomes something where it's sort of their lifestyle. They're living a life of a dream where it's a virtual thing, where it's all about what kind of pictures and lifestyle can I, what kind of movie can I create for myself that other people are going to see and comment on. You have young people, for example, who are struggling financially. But in order to, you know, kind of show themselves to other people like we're living a rich life, they'll spend tons of money, you know, going on expensive vacations, taking pictures, and give this sort of image off that, oh, we're doing so fine. But in reality, they're actually struggling. You have people who psychologically, they have huge problems because of the ups and downs and the emotions that go along with this. Brothers and sisters, is our life supposed to be led in a way that we're seeking the pleasure of others and that's what makes us happy and doesn't make us happy? We have a hadith from Imam Baqir alayhi salam. He says that if one of our Shia, if somebody truly is one of our Shia, if everyone in their city were to line up and tell them that you are a bad person, it shouldn't affect them even a bit. And if everyone in the city were to line up and say that you're a good person, it shouldn't affect them even a bit. We have another tradition from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. He says that you should try to be people who are not known. Meaning that you shouldn't be somebody, perhaps one of the interpretations is that don't be somebody who is seeking fame for yourself. He says that what does it matter to you if somebody praises you? What does it matter to you if somebody doesn't praise you or they look down upon you as long as you're praised in front of Allah Ta'ala? And brothers and sisters, there's nothing more comforting than to sort of push away all these likes and not likes and approvals and not approvals and I don't know, snap streaks and all this stuff and say that my pleasure is derived from the fact that I'm doing my responsibility in front of Allah. I don't care what other people have to say. The lifestyle, though, that's being taught is one of, like, it's called amal in Arabic. We have this Islamic concept of amal. Amal means when somebody is living a dream, a false dream. We have a hadith, for example, from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi. Where he says that there are two things that I fear from my ummah after me. One of them is ittiba'ul hawa, following their low desires. And the second one is tulul amal, that they're pursuing these far-fetched dreams. We don't want to live in a dream-like world. We want to live in reality. Now, just drawing to sort of the concrete and practical steps, you know, why is it that sometimes we have this hesitation of limiting access to devices for our children? I personally advise parents that when they're 18 years old, they're ready to go off to university, okay, that's the time. Before that, if you're going to give a child a device, basically, once it's theirs, good luck on trying to control it. You know, because it's like theirs, right? It's theirs. Now it's mine. I can do whatever I want with it. Do we need to have access to technology? And of course, right? I mean, we need to do that, but it doesn't have to be theirs, right? It can be done in a controlled sort of way. Sometimes parents feel that, okay, well, if I don't give my child a device, then my children are going to be bored. If they don't play these video games, then you know, many of the people here who lived before the dot-com era, right, we know that there used to be ways of being entertained that didn't involve devices. And some of these are extremely beneficial for the development of children, for the development of ourselves. Try this once, that instead of getting in front of the devices as a family, you know, sit down and do something like play a decent board game or a decent type of game which involves, like, let's say, you know, a word challenge or something like that. Right? Try this, that instead of doing that, go out for a walk. Right? Go out bike riding. Go to some greenery. Go climb a mountain or a hill if you have them. I don't know what you have here. Right? And then see the effect that has in terms of, like, what sort of incredible bonds are created because of these type of activities versus getting on the devices. Another reason why sometimes parents hesitate to do this type of thing, they say that, okay, well, our children need to have phones because they need to be able to call us in case there's emergencies that happen. Now, brothers and sisters, as you know, that for many centuries or many millennia, people lived without that and they were just fine. But if that's really a concern, then there's ways of doing that without giving them phones that have access to all these sort of things. And sometimes what happens is that parents think that, well, what's going to happen to my child if I don't do the same thing to them that everyone else is doing? Right? All of their peers, everyone in their class, they all have their devices, always chatting, they have all these, you know, Snapchats and stuff. I can't exclude my child from that. Really? You can't do that? Isn't being a Shia mean that, you know, you can sort of stand against the majority and you can say that I'm going to do what's right because it's right? It's very interesting. The people who are in the know, the people who understand technology, the people who created that technology, and they want their kids to be successful, they restrict technology for their kids. The wife of President Obama, right? She was quoted as saying that I'm happy if my children don't have Facebook accounts. I don't think it's useful for them. Steve Jobs, who created the iPad, he deliberately prevented his children from having access to the same device that he created. He was a genius. He knew what it could do for them. Bill Gates, he saw that his daughter, who was 14, was playing a video game. And video games at that time were different than video games right now. She was playing a video game at that time, and he saw negative effects in her behavior because of that. And as a result, he banned her from even chatting on her phone until she got much older. The current CEO of Apple, you know, he's in the position to understand this technology. He doesn't allow his nephew to access social networks. The vice president of Facebook has said, you know, if you look at the quotes that they have, they say that God only knows what Facebook is doing to our children's brains. Okay, this is a person who's in from the inside. They know what's going on, right? They know how much money has been spent to engineer these types of things to become addictive and to take away the minds and the hearts. And so on and so forth. There's so many quotes that we can give. There's entire, the most elite school in Silicon Valley, where the richest of the rich, they send their kids, and their goal is to make them materially successful. Technology is banned in that school. Not because they're scared of it or they don't want their children to use it. No, they're the ones who are the, you know, they're the titans of the Silicon Valley. But because they know that if you want children to be able to make choices in a clear way, you don't want to cloud their minds and their heart, you have to remove those distractions which prevent them from making those right choices. Now, brothers and sisters, the last thing I want to mention before we end up is that this same philosophy applies to the environment that our children are in as well, an environment that we put ourselves in as well. This attitude that I'm going to be somebody who's just, you know, an impervious, I have this impervious barrier around me, I can go anywhere and not be affected by it. It's a very naive type of approach. We are, as human beings, we're extremely sensitive to the environment that we're put into. If you're just with another human being, and that human being, just try, if they're, let's say, in a bad mood, you get affected by that. Right? And if you spend hours a day with somebody, then it's going to affect you. If it's the case that our children are in the, you know, the government schools and they're in environments where there's a lot of facade, there's a lot of atheism, there's a lot of denial of God, there's a lot of depravity of morals, there's a lot of, you know, these days they talk about, let's say, the sex ed, where there are a lot of things that Islam differs with, then what is our responsibility as parents? Is it the case that we're just going to let them suffer through and we'll see what happens at the end? Or is it that we need to actively be very, very on top of what's going on with them and monitor that and not allow them to be in a situation where their deen is going to be at risk? It's extremely important that parents are very involved with their children's education, know exactly what's happening, always be talking to them, always be talking to the administration. Let them know what you want. Let them know what you can tolerate, what you can't tolerate. We need to be active regarding this. When there's a plan to change the curriculum and a plan to introduce even more liberal values, then we as a community need to do something about that. We need to get active. We as a community need to also make sure that we're preparing and working on other projects that will allow us to eventually have our own means of doing tarbiyah, whether it be home education or whether it be the Islamic schools. And sometimes when you think about the enormity of the task, we say that, can we really do it? Brothers and sisters, our experience has been that if there's something which is important for us to do, and we sense that importance, and we're willing to work together, and we go about doing it the right way, Allah Ta'ala helps us. Even if it's something which is enormous as ensuring that our children are given the right tarbiyah and the right upbringing, we can do it with the help of Allah. I'll conclude now by just saying that, asking ourselves this question, that what do we want from our children, what do we want from ourselves? Tonight, inshallah, we're going to be soon commemorating and remembering this incredibly great figure who's so inspiring from the story of Karbala, Habib ibn Mudahir. Habib is one of those people who, from the time he was a child, he was somebody who was dedicated to serving the wali of his time. He was a companion of the Prophet. He participated in the battles. He was one of the Ashab al-Sirra of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. There's one incident that takes place in Kufa where one of the Shias bravely stands up and declares his support for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And Habib, when he hears somebody who's on the line of supporting the Imam alayhi salam despite the difficult situation, he can't control himself. He stands up and he says, Wallah, I swear by God, I swear by the one who is no God other than He, I am on the same path that you're on. Meaning that my whole life is, my whole life is that I want to be somebody who is a useful Shia. And this is what I want to ask ourselves, is that how useful are we to the Imam of our time? Our Imam needs helpers. Right? He's been waiting for a very long time. The children, our youth, ourselves, we don't want to waste this generation. Allah is very capable of bringing in more people. But we were here for a purpose. Let's see what we can do to actually accomplish it. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa alihi al-tahirin.